Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, as usual, with some unusual semi-rural birdsong perhaps in the background. In moments, we'll hear from Chris Maizano, who'll explore what the recent Supreme Court decision in the Janus case means for public employee unions. And at the bottom of the hour, Forrest Hilton will take a close look at Colombian politics after the election a couple of weeks ago. First, Janus. On June 27th, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of Janus versus the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees that workers could not be compelled to pay union dues against their will. This overturned a 1977 decision that said such an arrangement was fine. The right-wing legal infrastructure has been pushing for this for ages, and this is nothing short of a major victory for them, at least for now. Chris Maizano is in the National Political Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America, is a contributing editor of Jacobin, and a union staffer in New York. Here he is to tell us what it all means. Chris Maizano. So how dire is it, Chris?
It's dire. I think that there's no sugarcoating this decision at all. It should be seen for what it is, which is a major defeat for an already embattled labor movement, and it's the culmination of years, really, of right-wing anti-union judicial activism aimed at undermining organized labor's last remaining stronghold, which is the public sector. At the same time, you know, in public sector labor in particular, and then, among workers in general, there does seem to be something of an uptick in class struggle from below. The recent education strikes are the best example of that, but that's not the only thing that's going on out there. So that's grounds for hope. But if we're talking specifically about this decision and then kind of the larger outlook for organized labor, at least in the immediate term, it's not good. It's pretty bleak.
We must give the right credit. They've been planning this a long time. They have a real strategy behind this. This is a major accomplishment for them, right? And it's not just about the unions themselves. It's about the whole satellite structure of political organizing and activism that they support.
Absolutely. Yeah. This has been, I think, in the works for a long time, but they really wasted no time when the crisis hit back in 2008, 2009, to go on the offensive and use that crisis as an opening to really go on the attack and go on the offensive, both at the legislative level in various states around the country and then also at the judicial level. This is the, I think, third or fourth in a string of cases that started making their way through the court system a few years ago. It comes on the heels of a number of pieces of legislation that were passed in various states around the country, right-to-work laws, so-called paycheck protection laws, a whole raft of other anti-union pieces of legislation that have been passed, in a number of states that have been traditional union strongholds. And, these would be Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, elsewhere. And yes, you're right. This is frontally an attack on the public sector unions, but public sector unions and labor in general is, a major funder of a whole kind of constellation of organizations and advocacy groups that do all kinds of stuff. Just to give, one example would be something like the Economic Policy Institute, which, I know that you draw on a lot. You've had guests from there on your show. And yes, it's an attack specifically, first and foremost, on the unions, but they see the public sector unions in particular as kind of one of the main organizational linchpins of their political opposition. And
now we could debate just how fruitful the strategy of supporting the Fight for 15 has been for unions like SEIU, but SEIU is cutting its budget by about a third. Things like Fight for 15 are going to take major hits for that, right? I mean, this is not just going to affect SEIU itself, but a much broader set of movements.
Precisely. It will affect, the sorts of everyday things that unions do, things like collective bargaining, grievances, arbitrations, so on and so forth, that apply directly to union members. But yes, to the extent that unions are out there funding things like Fight for 15 or, say, voting rights organizations or advocacy groups that work with and on behalf of immigrants and things like that, I think it's going to inevitably take a toll. if you're talking about the broad left, such as it is in the United States, you know, unions are really, public sector unions in particular, are really one of the major linchpins and sources of funding for these kinds of things. So if that dries up, then, you know, that whole constellation of organizations and groups and outfits is probably going to be in some trouble. You know, they'll look for alternative sources of funding for sure, but the unions are a major source of funding for those sorts of things.
I've heard a lot of contradictory stories on precisely how ready the unions have been for this. You know, certainly it's been in the pipeline for a long time. Some people say their unions have done nothing, haven't communicated internally, don't seem organizationally ready. Other people tell me that their unions have been on top of it. What's your reading of just how ready the labor movement was for this decision?
It's a good question, and unfortunately I think it's kind of hard to know. I think the preparations have been, you know, more or less all over the map. I think there are definitely certain cases where unions have seen the writing on the wall, that we could have gotten this decision 2 years ago, and it probably would have happened 2 years ago in the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association case if Antonin Scalia hadn't died in the middle of that term. So, you know, in the wake of that in particular, you know, I think some unions have done a pretty decent job of doing, you know, what needed to be done to prepare as best as we possibly could for this eventuality, making sure that people are being re-signed on membership cards, dues deduction cards, those sorts of things, trying to rebuild some level of workplace organization. I'm sure there are probably local unions in particular out there that have not done a particularly good job of this and are going to run into some problems in the wake of this decision, particularly because the ruling does a couple of things. In addition to doing right to work in the entire public sector, it also mandates a sort of opt-in system so that when people get hired, they need to take active steps to opt into membership as opposed to an opt-out system, which, you know, would make life a little bit easier for the unions. And then also it basically says that, you know, the unions are going to have to prove that people have affirmatively consented to making dues payments and having those deducted from their paychecks. So if there hasn't been adequate levels of preparation leading up to this, then there are lawsuits filed by the right wing basically asking unions to prove their membership, prove that people have given them the green light to make dues deductions, that, you know, if they can't do that, then they're going to run into some problems. But it's hard to know. It's hard to know the extent to which specific unions have done the groundwork to prepare for this. It's just, you know, mostly anecdotal what you hear.
Now, what's your response to the right wing's general argument here? I imagine some people might be sympathetic to the argument that you shouldn't be forced to pay dues to an organization you don't want to belong to. How do you respond to that?
It's a challenging argument and in certain senses kind of difficult one to respond to. I mean, however, you know, much you might disagree with it, it's, you know, a fundamentally kind of political argument. And I think it has an intuitive kind of logic to it for a lot of people. I think in the absence of other arguments, you know, a lot of people would hear that and say, okay, yeah, that makes sense to me. Unfortunately, you know, in my view, I think most of the arguments that are given against that point of view about, you know, forced speech and all those sorts of things tend to be couched in the pretty boring and bloodless language of microeconomics, you know, language about, you know, free riding and all that sort of thing. That's certainly relevant and a problem for unions and their kind of organizational wherewithal. But if you're putting up those kinds of arguments about, you know, free riding and what have you that are fairly arcane and technical up against, you know, these political arguments coming out of the right on the grounds of things like free speech and free association, I don't think the sorts of free rider or kind of microeconomic arguments we make have the same sort of bite or punch or appeal. The union's main defense in these cases have been, you know, outside of things like direct spending on candidates and lobbying, the things that unions do are fundamentally not political. If you're a progressive, if you're a person on the left and you see the unions potentially as a force for, you know, progressive social change in the country, that's, you know, strange argument to make. It's the one that the unions, I think, had to make in the context of these court cases and in the context of this litigation. But I just don't see it as anywhere close to as strong of an argument as what we've been hearing, as wrongheaded as they may be. And, you know, they make it for very cynical reasons.
Some people have been saying in the wake of this decision that there may actually be a silver lining, that unions will have to work harder, prove that they really deserve dues money, and having, you know, activated loyal membership will actually prove to be a good thing in the long term. Bob Fitch used to make this argument, and people hated him for it. He thought the closed shop actually undermined union militancy. You can make the historical argument that the current labor structure developed after World War II as an attempt to put a cap on militancy and quiet an angry rank and file. So maybe this decision will actually unleash a new wave of militancy. Now look at the red state teacher strikes, where unions are barely legal, if at all. This kind of rank and file energy far outstripped what the leadership was capable of. What do you say to that?
I think there's something to that argument. The sort of system, the institutional system that we have here in the U.S., which has been based for the last few decades on, the combination of the union shop or the agency shop and exclusive representation, does offer, every incentive for a union organization to rest on its laurels and, rely on this sort of almost automatic stream of income in order to keep itself going. When you have those sorts of things, you don't necessarily have to be in constant communication and contact with your members and to be constantly organizing them to take action in the workplace or in the streets or in politics or whatever the case may be. There's something to that argument, but I think there is probably also a danger in overdoing it as well. Whatever flaws and limitations unions have, this is really kind of the only real organizational and institutional framework that working people in this country have of any real consequence. In states where labor has institutionally been relatively strong over the last few decades, New York is still one of those states. Once these sorts of protections and forms of union security that have been in place for a few decades go away, and after decades of union members getting used to looking at their unions as sort of like an insurance company, something that you put money into in return for services, I think it's going to be difficult to flip the switch or kind of redirect or reposition these organizations so that they're much more capable of and interested in organizing their members and engaging in the sorts of collective action that they've done in the past and what we've seen in places like West Virginia over the last few months. It's going to be tough to turn these organizations around and to activate the sorts of collective action that we're going to need to see if workers are going to defend themselves and make gains.
I'm speaking with Chris Mazzano, a contributing editor of Jacobin and a member of DSA's political committee. What do we know from what has happened in states like Wisconsin, where something like a local version of Janus happened? What's likely to happen to the public sector unions as this decision takes hold?
That's a good question. I think it's, before answering it, I think it's worth noting that the Act 10, that infamous Act 10 in Wisconsin that was passed, I believe it was back in 2011, goes further than just doing open shop or right to work. It does various other things that, restrict the scope of bargaining and undermine the legal institutional position of unions. I mean, that being said, the combined effect of Act 10 and the subsequent right to work bill in Wisconsin has been, it's been a disaster for the most part. Union membership is there in that state has really fallen off the table. I think I've seen reports of wages and benefits for public sector workers in that state really taking a hit. Another thing, another effect that it had in a place like Wisconsin is because the unions are smaller, because there's fewer workers receiving political messages that at least on one level kind of counteract whatever they might be receiving from people like Donald Trump. These are states that Trump narrowly won, and maybe he wouldn't have done so if things like Act 10 and these right-to-work laws hadn't been passed. So the last few years probably would have been a lot different if labor had succeeded in defeating Act 10 in Wisconsin. Maybe you don't see the subsequent attack on labor in all the surrounding states. Maybe you don't see these various cases in the judicial system moving through so quickly and being so successful. It's taken a huge toll on unions in that state. There's also been some bright spots. My understanding is that the teachers union in Milwaukee has been able to maintain a very high level of membership, even with membership being strictly voluntary now. And they've been able to make some gains through collective action and waging kind of mass campaigns both to defend themselves and to improve the quality of public education in the city. But, on the whole, it's been very bad for the unions in that state and for working people in that state.
Are there any other horrors in the right-wing legal pipeline that we have to be on guard for now?
Yeah, if you read the decision, the opinion written by Alito, he opens the door to, just another round of judicial attacks on the labor movement. It's likely based on this decision that right-wing legal outfits are going to start challenging the constitutionality of exclusive representation. as well as, you know, any number of additional kind of fundamental mechanisms that we've come to kind of take for granted in the world of organized labor. I think it's also probably just a matter of time before, either through congressional legislation or another Supreme Court case, that right to work goes from, you know, the public sector to the private sector. You know, it's going to be very easy for someone to make the argument that, hey, if this applies to government employees, it should apply to private sector employees as well. Yeah, in that sense, it's only going to be a matter of time, barring some fairly major changes in the balance of political forces in the country. This is the culmination, I think, of one kind of cycle of judicial activism aimed at undermining unions, but I think it only opens the door to another one that could potentially be even more fundamental than that.
I'm allergic to the Supreme Court, so I really only could bear to skim Alito's opinion, but what I saw some excerpt from it in which he was explicitly quite political in his argument about the effects of unions, like, you know, their effects on public pensions and such. This was very clearly a political decision, not just a narrow free speech decision or anything like that, right? He was really talking about class struggle.
Yeah, he makes a number of arguments along those lines. You know, for example, he says that things have changed since the previous decision in 1977. Government spending has increased. Social services have increased. You know, kind of debt and deficits for government employers have increased, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, in his view, this is because of the growth of public sector unions. And, you know, in his mind, this is one reason why they need to be kind of reined in and undermined. I remember following the oral arguments from the case back in February, and it was Kennedy, I believe, who almost went even harder on these questions. And, you know, I think asked the union's lawyer a basic question like, you know, doesn't agency shop increase your power or something like that? And he says yes, and he's like, well, then isn't that the end of this case? So it wasn't just Alito, it was some of the other justices on the court as well, like Kennedy, that, yeah, we're really making fundamentally political arguments and were very aggressive in their argumentation and in their questioning. So from their point of view, yeah, I think that they see this as a straightforwardly kind of political argument. It's not just narrow and legal and technical. To me, that's one of the interesting things, you know, comparing the arguments that people on the right have been making against unions and against things like the agency shop and the defenses that have been offered. You know, they've taken a very straightforwardly political approach to these kinds of questions, and by and large, our responses, I think, have been fairly technical, fairly arcane, and don't have the same kind of punch or bite.
Well, why is that?
I think that's an interesting question. It's kind of the contradiction of union security itself, right? And I kind of tried to chart this a little bit in the article that I wrote for Jacobin. So, you know, over time, in the kind of formative stages of the movement, you know, unions had to be fundamentally political in almost everything that they did, I think both internally and then in their orientation to the larger society, you know, seeing themselves as kind of movements for social justice, as social movements that have larger goals than just kind of the immediate economic interests of their members. And then over time, as they make organizational gains and they receive these sorts of kind of external guarantees of security from the political system, and as they kind of win influence and power within, you know, especially Democratic Party administrations at the state and local level, they want to do everything that they can to protect those external guarantees. So, you know, you try to present yourself as reasonable and responsible, and you're not really trying to rock the boat. You're not necessarily seeing yourself as kind of a broader movement for social justice and for progressive politics anymore. You're kind of seeing yourself as a responsible, like, labor market agent or something along those lines, rather than a political force. So I think it's kind of embedded in those contradictions of union security itself, and, you know, wanting to maintain good relationships with politicians and with, you know, government agency heads and all those sorts of things. So as I said in the piece, I think winning these things are and going for these things like agency shops, union shops, makes sense. It's a rational approach to trying to solve some very basic organizational problems, but it comes with its own contradictions and limitations, and over time can really make the unions vulnerable if the broader political situation changes and whoever's in charge decides to go after these things.
To pick up on your rock the boat metaphor, like, the boat has a big hole in it. It's been taking on water now for, what, almost four decades. Reagan broke PATCO 37 years ago. And they're still not seeing the necessity for some more political argument?
Yeah, the boat has had a hole in it, I think, for workers as a whole and, you know, the labor movement as a whole for the last four decades. But if you look at the unionization rate, the union density rate for public sector unions since that period, you know, since the late 70s, early 80s, it's been pretty constant. You don't see too much fluctuation. It's, you know, kind of stayed in kind of a level somewhere between 35% and 40% for government employees, you know, most of that being at the state and local level. And then if you look at certain particular states or certain particular localities, you know, the union membership rates are much higher. You see the, like, Scandinavian rates of public sector union membership in places like New York or California or Illinois or whatever the case may be. Also partially accounts for this. You know, overall, if you look at kind of overall unionization rates, if you look at the overall situation confronting workers, yeah, the situation is clearly pretty bad. But at least if you're looking at this question from the standpoint of the immediate organizational or institutional positions of public sector unions, most of which are at the state and local level, things have been pretty constant. And I think that's why there's the tendency to not want to rock the boat, the tendency to not want to you know, potentially jeopardize relationships with politicians and what have you.
But now this has all been radically transformed in the public sector.
Yeah, it has been, and it's going to be interesting to see what the long-term effect of this is. In some states, you know, dominated by Democrats, there were some preemptive moves to kind of stave off the worst effects of this kind of decision. So here in New York State, back in April, as they were working on the state budget, you know, Cuomo signed a bill that made some amendments to the state's public sector labor law, making it a little bit harder for members to drop their membership, you know, making sure that unions have the ability to meet with new hires at something within 30 days of their date of hire, and some other things that will, you know, mitigate the impact of this kind of thing on union membership and union revenues. But the decision and some of the language in the decision, I don't think that many of these things will last. And yeah, over time, as you know, union membership probably declines and the financial wherewithal of public sector unions also declines, you know, it's going to, I think, change the calculus on both the union side and the side of politicians and government employers. And I think that what exactly will shake out, I think, is difficult to predict. But yeah, that situation is definitely going to change.
And it just seems like we don't have anybody thinking as strategically as they do.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. And I think a lot of this, you know, kind of boils down to the fact that, you know, as the employers, as the bosses, as capital, all the cards are stacked in their favor. They have the opportunity, the resources, et cetera, to be strategic, to play a long game and all those sorts of things. When you're on labor side, even if you manage to build up large institutions with big memberships and big treasuries and all this kind of thing, I think just kind of the nature of being on that side of the equation, on the worker side of the equation, means that, you know, you're constantly on the defensive. You run into organizational and collective action problems that that the boss doesn't run into. It's difficult just to maintain whatever position that you've won, rather than, you know, try to build on that or go on the offensive. When you're in labor, you're doing a lot of responding to crises and putting out fires, rather than trying to take a long-term or strategic view. And I think that's just in the nature of trying to organize workers who in capitalism are a subordinate social group and, you know, have the basic problem of trying to challenge the relationships of power instead of maintaining them.
I was Chris Maizano, a member of the National Political Committee of DSA and a contributing editor at Jacobin. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the first movement of Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 11, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. Next, Columbia, On June 17th, Ivan Duque, an obscure lawyer who'd spent more than a decade working in Washington, was elected president of that country. He's a protege of Alvaro Uribe, a veteran politician who was president of Colombia from 2002 to 2010. Uribe pulled lots of strings during the reign of his successor, Juan Manuel Santos. In 2016, Santos reached a peace deal with the armed rebels known as the FARC, with the aim of ending a bloody and expensive civil war that had lasted over 50 years. Uribe sabotaged that deal, which was defeated in a national referendum, though Santos and the Congress managed to push it through anyway. And now a new president, Duque, will have to contend with the shadow power of Alvaro Uribe. Although the right has held firm power in Colombia for a long time, a candidate of the left, Gustavo Petro, made a very strong showing. Here's Forrest Hilton, a historian who teaches at the National University of Colombia in Medellin, to tell us what it all means. He's the co-author of a piece on the website of the North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA.org, on the topic. Forrest Hilton. Some change, some continuity, as you say, the title of your NACLA piece. Let's talk about what continues. Uribismo continues in some sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it, Uribismo is a kind of 21st century phenomenon. Even though Alvaro Uribe, former president of Colombia from 2002 to 2010, emerged out of the sort of most corrupt circles of liberal party politics. He became president as an independent candidate, and by building his own constituency, following, and political party, essentially smashed the two-party system that had ruled Colombia since the mid-1840s. And this broad right-wing coalition that both includes the liberal and conservative parties and goes far beyond them, overshadowing them, is what has dominated Colombia in the 21st century. So Alvaro Uribe was elected president twice. He re-engineered the 1991 constitution so that he could win the elections, which were clearly fraudulent in 2006. And then Juan Manuel Santos came to power in 2010 and ruled for the last two terms until now. And he negotiated a peace agreement with the FARC. But there really weren't any significant differences between Uribe and Santos on political economy and Colombia's sort of development plans. And Santos had been Alvaro Uribe's minister of defense in the period in which roughly 10,000 innocent civilians were disappeared to make the body count look better in Colombia's war on the Revolutionary Armed Forces, the FARC. So Santos and Uribe really aren't as distinct as it might appear, but nevertheless, Uribe is clearly the leader of this broad right-wing coalition, which has now won three elections in the 21st century outside the traditional liberal conservative bipartisan system.
Santos did make peace, though, and would Uribe have done that? Was there some difference in that regard?
Yes, there's a difference insofar as Uribe wants the peace of sort of Versailles after World War I, in which Germany was required to pay for essentially the entire cost of World War I. And that's what Uribe would like to have the FARC do. He would like to make them pay. To Uribe's way of thinking, Santos, rather than extracting the concessions that any sort of victor would naturally extract, handed the keys of the country to the FARC so that they could do politics as they wish, so that they could avoid going to jail. And Uribe aims to change all that and make sure that at least some FARC leaders go to jail rather than the Senate or Congress. And is certainly dedicated to making sure that neither politicians, nor businessmen, nor military people will be judged in these new special courts. And he has further plans for the justice system. He plans to collapse the three branches of the Supreme Court in Colombia into one, and that would do away with the investigation currently underway for wiretapping and surveillance when Alvaro Uribe was president, that is in the hands right now of the Supreme Court. And so by folding the three branches of the judicial system into one, Uribe could, in theory, get out from under this Supreme Court investigation for wiretapping and surveillance. So the right has big plans for how it's going to reconfigure Colombia's institutions in the first administration after the peace process.
Now, you speak of Uribe as the real power here. Is he the power behind the throne, even though he's not the nominal president?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to Russia, right, when Putin was in charge, yet not. So Uribe is the one who has all of the experience, the contacts in the military, in the judiciary. He himself is in the Senate leading the Centro Democrático, his party, and the party that won the presidential elections, they have a majority in Congress, so it should be pretty easy for Duque to push through all sorts of projects through Congress. Uribe is the one who has the contacts in the media as well as, you know, all of the important institutions like the evangelical sects as well as the Catholic Church. Insofar as Iván Duque really was a technocrat working in Washington, D.C. at the Inter-American Development Bank for, I don't remember whether it was 12 or 13 years, that's mainly what he's done. And as recently as 18 months ago, something like less than 20% of Colombians had ever heard of him. So he is the candidate that Uribe chose. In Spanish, in Colombia, they say, el que diga Uribe, whoever Uribe says. So that's who won the elections is, you know, who Uribe said would win the elections.
But with that portfolio of a dozen or so years at the IADB, he's got, I presume, the technocratic skills to continue the neoliberal part of the agenda.
Exactly. And I think there will probably be a division of labor to some degree. That will be presumably his main responsibility, which plays to his strengths. You know, his strengths are clearly sort of administrative and technocratic, and I don't think there's any doubt about his competence in that respect. But then the darker side of business, politics, business and politics, will involve sort of persecuting and punishing enemies, which was really what Uribe specialized in as president from 2002 to 2010. And in fact, he's so good at it that he was able to defeat Santos in the referendum on peace in October 2016, just barely, but nevertheless, a majority of voters who turned out to decide on whether Colombia should abide by the peace process signed in Havana or should reject it. A narrow majority rejected it, and that was because Uribe simply outflanked Santos by persecuting and stigmatizing the entire peace campaign as essentially a Trojan horse for the communist takeover of the country. That would turn it into the next Venezuela. So the next Venezuela thing sort of started during the campaign to block the referendum on peace, and then it really heated up in the electoral campaign. And it's a winning formula.
Yeah, I was about to ask that question. Venezuela, the neighbor of Colombia, the crisis in that society has really had quite the influence in Venezuelan politics, right? Played a big role in the referendum, but also this presidential campaign. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's no question that the collapse of the Bolivarian project has helped shift Colombian politics even further to the right. There's a sense in which when Uribe was in power in the earlier period, Chavez really held the keys insofar as he would just simply shut down the Venezuelan-Colombian border. And Colombia at that time was so dependent on imports coming through Venezuela as well as exports to Venezuela for what little remains of its industry beyond narcotics and gas and petroleum and coal and mining and so forth. As long as Chavez was president, Chavez could really push the FARC to consider peace seriously and keep Uribe to some degree at bay simply by closing down the border anytime tensions rose beyond a certain point and Uribe's rhetoric became more bellicose and so forth. That situation has obviously changed dramatically, and more than a million Venezuelans have come into Colombia in the last year and a half, insofar as Colombia does not have a history of in-migration from other countries, very different from Venezuela, which has had a whole wave of migrant groups throughout the 20th century. Colombia has largely avoided having immigrants, so this is unprecedented. What's interesting is that many of the Venezuelans coming into Colombia today are themselves descendants of or even the very people who left Colombia in the 1970s, particularly millions of Colombians went to work in Venezuela during the oil boom of the 1970s. Ironically, right, the sort of rentier Petro state in Venezuela has really collapsed, and that has sent waves of migrants, many of them either Colombian or of Colombian descent, back to Colombia, which of course has impacted labor markets quite dramatically, especially at the bottom end of the scale, since Venezuelans work very efficiently and obediently for very low wages, undercutting their Colombian competition.
So that's almost a magic bullet for the right. You've got refugees are certainly not the most popular people around the world today, plus the collapse of a socialist model nearby. So this is the manna for right-wing propagandists, isn't it?
Indeed. It would appear that it fell from heaven, and it is quite different from the situation when Uribe was president the first time around, and Chavez and Lula exercised diplomatic leadership throughout the hemisphere, right? Evo Morales came to power in Bolivia. Rafael Correa was pushing forward a new constitution and what he called a civic revolution in Ecuador. Obviously, today, the panorama has changed dramatically in South America in particular, with the legislative and parliamentary coup in Brazil, the return of the right in Argentina, the return of Uribe in Colombia. And now with the elections in Mexico, it appears that perhaps something important exists in the way of a check or a balance on that drift. But nevertheless, Uribe comes back to power in a situation in which the right has made fairly significant advances compared to where it was when he was president the first time around.
You say in this piece, the NACLA piece, that Colombia has historically been quite a conservative country. Why is that?
Well, that has to do with the weakness of the left and with the weakness of kind of social movements in Colombia. There's a similar history to the United States insofar as organized labor was essentially allied with liberal forces in the 1930s, coming out of a pretty insurgent phase in the 1920s. It was fairly successfully incorporated into the existing order. Social movements outside of organized labor in the countryside, for example, really had a difficult time coming together and fully coalescing beyond the local or the regional level, in part because Colombia is a very regionally fragmented country. It has been and has remained so. Bogota is a very weak governing center. Insofar as labor was successfully incorporated into the Liberal Party, there was communist leadership of the labor movement, but outside a very small area, the left and the Communist Party were not really able to make serious inroads in the part of the countryside where coffee was cultivated, and that's where the majority of rural workers in Colombia lived, and it was also kind of the axis of Colombian economic, political, and social development all through the 20th century. So the long and short of it is there was never a powerful insurgent movement from below in the coffee axis, which was at the center of Colombia's political economy. The trade union movement was relatively weak, relatively fragmented, and relatively incorporated into the Liberal Party. And the Communist Party ended up betting on a strategy of rural insurrection rooted in these guerrilla movements that really grew out of peasant self-defense units on agrarian frontiers. The most important organization on the Colombian left, the Colombian Communist Party, was allied with the most important guerrilla organization, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, from the mid-1960s, really up until probably the collapse of the peace process between the FARC and the government of Andrés Pastrana in the 1990s. So insofar as rural insurrection was the strategic and to some degree tactical horizon of the most important organizations on the Colombian left, social movements from below remain sort of fragmented and weak because the FARC strategy and the Colombian Communist Party strategy of combining what they call all forces of struggle, which is to say trying to participate in electoral politics through a political party they founded in the 1980s, while at the same time expanding their number of fronts and preparing to sort of scale up the war effort, that, of course, gave the far right, which is to say death squads linked to narco-traffickers, landlords, retired military and police officials, intelligence units of the army and so forth, they came together. That's really the origins of this broad right coalition that's ruling Colombia in the 21st century. They really came together starting in the 1980s, and they adopted the same strategy as the Communist Party and the FARC of combining all forces of struggle, which is to say they tried to penetrate legitimate institutions of the state, and they did so successfully. They also successfully ran candidates, particularly through the existing two-party structure. And, of course, they targeted social movement activists, labor activists, as guerrillas in civilian clothes. Since the FARC was engaging in electoral politics, they had a perfect pretext with which to stigmatize all forms of social protest and mobilization.
I'm speaking with the historian Forrest Hilton. Back to Uribe, what accounts for this character's durability and pervasive power?
He has irons and a lot of fires, I guess would be one way to put it. So the Supreme Court is investigating him right now for wiretapping and surveillance. A scandal in which all but one of the witnesses have mysteriously been murdered after being arrested, held, and released. The Supreme Court justices who are currently investigating Uribe are themselves now being investigated, and their personal sort of finances are being scrutinized, and all sorts of information about them is being leaked to the media. So essentially, he is orchestrating a very sophisticated campaign to delegitimate the Supreme Court justices who are investigating him in the run-up, presumably, to collapsing the three branches of the judicial system as it exists into one. So the ability, for example, to go after Supreme Court justices successfully while they're investigating him without really suffering any consequences, that would be one indication of his power. Another indication of his power is that he owns probably more land than any other individual, single individual. I'm sure there are corporations and particularly transnational mining companies that own, or at least lease, far more than Uribe. But Uribe, as an individual, is rumored to be the largest land owner in the country, and this in a country in which landlords are disproportionately represented in Congress as well as regional and local power structures, which is to say the state at the regional and local level overlaps with landlord power in an almost kind of feudal dynamic. So his ability to sort of knit together the political structures of business and organized crime locally and regionally to unite sort of landlords behind a maximalist program of all stolen lands will remain in the hands of those who stole them, and no lands will be returned to people who were displaced from them and who are now reclaiming their right to return to the lands that were stolen from them. So Uribe really represents a defense of absolute private property rights come hell or high water, and that includes literally millions of hectares of land that were stolen when Uribe was president. And they were stolen from peasants, from Afro-Colombian communities, from indigenous communities, from a whole range of probably middle-class farmers as well. Anybody who wasn't willing to sell at the price that was being offered would be displaced. So that's why Colombia has the largest number of internally displaced people in the world, which is, say, more than Syria, and why it has one of the highest rural Gini coefficients in the world, which is the measure of inequality. So it's an unbelievably unequal land tenure system that has gotten even more so as this Uribe-led right has become more powerful in the 21st century. And there is no way, seemingly, to break their chokehold on the economic development model of monocropping, agro-industry, and cattle ranching, which involves the displacement of all these millions of people. And, you know, even it would seem that this kind of power now extends to the ability to persecute the Supreme Court itself. So Uribe is this figure who unites sort of all these different levels of criminality connected to the state and connected to the creation of private property, individual private property, where a great deal of land was held collectively or worked communally. So Uribe is also the figure who negotiated the best deals, not for the Colombian government, but for the multinationals, the mining companies, the gas and oil companies. Anybody who has tried to get a piece of Colombia in the 21st century got fantastic terms under Uribe. They also got very good terms under Santos. Favorable terms continued. But with Uribe, there was a sense that the country was being raffled off, and the time for multinational investors in particular to get in on the action was then. So in terms of creating an unusually favorable investment climate, particularly for multinationals, but also for sort of domestic oligarchs, Uribe, again, is looked upon very favorably by these very powerful corporations, as well as landlords, as well as multinational oil and gas companies.
All is not grim, however. There is a bright spot in that the left candidate, Gustavo Petro, had a pretty strong showing. Tell us about him and what that means.
So Gustavo Petro comes out of this kind of left nationalist guerrilla movement, M19, which was the closest thing to a kind of popular urban left that Colombia had in the Cold War, insofar as M19 recognized that kind of the future of Colombian politics was going to be decided in its cities, and this strategic horizon of rural insurrection was really problematic in a country that was ever more urbanized. And it was coffee exports that financed the development of light manufacturing and particularly textiles in Medellin, in Cali, and Bogota. But of course, there's a shift away from that model to a more neoliberal extractive model of development, which brings about a huge wave of deindustrialization, which means that the people flooding into the cities are no longer flooding into cities that are creating sort of formal waged employment, and they wind up in what's euphemistically called the informal sector. They have to make a living by selling whatever they can sell, so they become petty merchants of all sorts. It's a really heterogeneous kind of class composition that comes to predominate in cities. Gustavo Petro came out of a movement that identified these people as politically important. But because it had a horizon of insurrectionism, which is to say, after the civic strike of 1977, all the armed organizations on the left believe that Colombia was ready for another uprising, and this time it would be an armed uprising, and there was competition among the leading guerrilla groups, the FARC, the ELN, and M19, to decide who would be the vanguard of this revolution, and M19 tried to position itself as the vanguard of this urban revolution. Now, this is important because Gustavo Petro then becomes mayor of Bogota. Before Petro, there had been two nominally leftist mayors of Bogota, one of whom wound up in jail and for corruption, and the other of whom left the city in a state of real disaster. And Petro did a much more competent job of running the city of Bogota, which is a nearly impossible task. He confronted some fairly formidable oligarchic interests in the city, for example, the garbage mafia, and really through all sorts of social democratic programs, essentially at the municipal level, won the support of these popular sectors in the city that really never had political representation, that have never found a proper political vehicle. And that's in part what Gustavo Petro represented this time around in the campaign. He had a huge impact in cities like Barranquilla, Cali, and almost all cities except Medellin, which is Uribe's stronghold because Uribe is from Medellin and because that's where his political machinery is at its most formidable. So Petro, in a sense, represents the possibility of an urban left that we really haven't seen in Colombia throughout the whole Cold War period, for reasons I've tried to explain, having to do with the strategic horizon of the Colombian left on, you know, in terms of rural insurrection versus sort of organizing in urban neighborhoods that were filling up with people who had no chance of finding manufacturing employment, who could not hope for a social ascent through public education, but could really only hope for social ascent through participation in the narcotics business and different forms of organized crime.
How hopeful or hopeless is it on balance?
Well, insofar as Petro picked up 42% of the vote in the second round, I would say it's quite hopeful in electoral terms. Gustavo Petro now will be leading opposition from the Senate. As an opposition senator back in Uribe's first two terms in office, Petro was extremely effective. And it was really, in fact, his best moment, I think, as a politician. Although at that time, when he was investigating narco-paramilitarism in Medellin and Antioquia in the period when Álvaro Uribe was governor of Antioquia, Petro, in a sense, was quite alone. Of course, there were social movements supporting him, but there really wasn't much visibility. Now, coming off the peace process, there's been a lot more sort of social mobilization in support of peace, in support of alternative economic development policies, support for a completely different way of thinking about the environment and living in relation to nature in Colombia. All of these things Petro has put on the agenda, and he has won very widespread support among people of African descent who are quite numerous in Colombia. It's hard to say what the percentage would be, but perhaps somewhere about 20-30%. It's hard to count. Indigenous population is much smaller, but they're very highly mobilized. And in regions where there are large percentages of indigenous people, such as the Guajira, Petro did very well. the excluded nation of Colombia, if you will, the urban peripheries and then the kind of lowland and tropical peripheries, whether it's the Pacific, the Caribbean, or the Amazonian region of Colombia, the possibility of them coming together and cohering as a kind of national, popular, I would say it's pretty moderate social democracy, and I would say it's pretty much in line with the best traditions of the Liberal Party of the 20th century, which is to say we're not talking about a particularly radical project. But because the right is so maximalist, and because they see this as a moment in which they can really press their victory to its most extreme, it's hard to say which way the balance is going to tilt. But I don't think that prospects for democratic opposition in Colombia, particularly based in cities, have ever looked better. But that doesn't change the fact that cities are, for the most part, in the grip of gang violence connected to drug trafficking and organized crime. But if anybody can come up with interesting proposals and ideas from the legislature that are well articulated with what social movements themselves are articulating, it's Gustavo Petro. So I would say that it's likely to be very interesting in the coming years to contrast the kind of emerging model of some kind of fairly tepid social democracy represented by Petro and his supporters and this kind of extremely violent neoliberal extractivist and agro-industrial model. So as the comrades used to say, I think that the contradictions are intentifying.
I was Forrest Hilton, a historian who teaches at the National University of Colombia in Medellin. His book, Evil Hour in Colombia, was published by Verso in 2006. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Fugue No. 7 by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the pianist Vladimir Ashkenazy. Till next week, bye.